Chapter 6, Life Aboard. Long periods of separation from shoreside institutions and conventional employment led to the rise of a unique occupational identity. A discreet shipboard culture with its own characteristic protocols, traditions, and indigenous arts. The sailors' journal keeping, scrimshaw, painting, drawing, poetry, music, theatricals, and ritual life, all rooted in the circumstances and conditions of being at sea, provide eyewitness insights into the hardships and privations of sea voyaging. Logbooks, the official record of the activities of a whaling voyage, were the duty of the chief first mate. They described the day-to-day events, including the position of the vessel, the sail she was under, the wind speed and direction, the activities of the crew, any whale seen or taken, and at times more interesting and illuminating recordings. Although whaling was a male occupation that separated men from their families for years, women and children also shared their isolation. Those back at home had to learn to make do without the men in their lives. Additionally, scholars have identified several dozen sister sailors who joined their husbands at sea, sometimes accompanied by children, beginning in about 1822. Their letters and journals reveal much about women's roles aboard. Some assumed important shipboard responsibilities or proved courageous in a crisis, but the predominant theme seems to have been one of loneliness and boredom. However, when two friendly whalers met at sea, gamming would commence. The captain of one vessel, with the boat's crew, would go aboard the second whaler, while the first mate remained behind to entertain the mate and the boat's crew from the other craft. A whaling voyage was marked by long periods of boredom, followed by spurts of frenzy when whales were sighted. The lookout's call of "Thar she blows" from the crow's nest at the masthead was the signal for those below to spring into action. Whaleboats were lowered into the sea to pursue, by sail and oar, the intended quarry. With luck and skill, the harpooner would attach to the whale, and a Nantucket sleigh ride to tire the beast would ensue. Once exhaustion befell the Leviathan, a lance would finish this part of the undertaking. After getting a whale back to the whale ship, processing the blubber was a laborious chore that took 1 to 3 days to complete. An enormous variety of whale craft developed to make the job feasible. Upon completion of a voyage, the vessel returned to port with her hold filled with casks of oil. There, the cargo was offloaded, tested, graded, and sold. Owners and masters could make a great deal of money from a successful, greasy whaling voyage. The reality for those on the bottom of the whale ship hierarchy was that after years of backbreaking work, they could end the voyage actually owing money to the ship for clothing, tobacco, and other necessities purchased along the way. The hardships did not always end with the voyage. Many were compelled to sign on to another trip to pay off their debts. There is a unique lexicon amongst whalers, and many of these expressions survive today. Perhaps the most enduring were those that described the hunt. "Thar she blows." A masthead lookout scanned the open ocean, looking for spouts of vapor that signaled whales breathing at the surface. Whenever spouts were seen, the lookouts would holler out, "Thar she blows." The whaleboats would be lowered, and the hunt was on. "Lower away." After whales had been sighted, the command was to lower away the boats. The whales were hunted from small boats specially built for the purpose. Ships commonly carried between 3 and 5 whaleboats, each always with a crew of 6 men. After the boats were lowered, they could be either rowed or sailed to where the whales were last seen. A dead whale or stove boat. Good whalemen were careful, courageous, and reckless. Careful in approaching whales, courageous in moving alongside and harpooning a swimming whale, and often reckless when moving close enough to kill a fighting whale. Boats that were damaged or destroyed by fighting whales were said to be stove. The phrase reflects the care and reckless courage it took to actually do battle with whales. His chimney's afire. When a whale had been repeatedly lanced, it spouted blood, and the whaleman said, "His chimney's afire." If the blood was thin, the wound was not always mortal. If the blood was thick, the whale soon went into its flurry and turned fin out. The flurry was a dangerous time for the men. The boats commonly backed away and waited for the whale to die and turn over on its side with one fin sticking up. 5 and 40 more. A bull sperm whale that produced 45 barrels of oil was the average take in the industry. When the last piece of blubber was hauled aboard, the crew would commonly chant out, 5 and 40 more, meaning their vessel was 45 barrels closer to being full and homeward bound. Bible leaves. Processing the blubber of a single whale was a laborious process. Cutting spades, blubber hooks, boarding and mincing knives, pikes, tripods, balers, strainers, and casks illustrate the different jobs assigned on board once a whale was caught. Blubber chunks, about 10 inches wide by 2 feet long, called horse pieces, were processed into Bible leaves at the mincing horse, a wooden frame and large tub close to the tryworks. Made a voyage. Captains stayed at sea for a specific period of time. Successful voyages would often send oil home by another vessel and remain at sea until cargo was complete. Unsuccessful voyages would return home with whatever oil and baleen had been taken. Once the hold contained enough full casks of oil, the captain would declare that the vessel had made a voyage and it was time to return to home port. Chapter 6, Profile of Annie Holmes Ricketson. Annie Holmes Ricketson was born in Fall River, Massachusetts in 1841 and married her first husband, Daniel L. Ricketson, in 1857. As the wife of a New Bedford whaleship master, she decided to pack her trunk and accompany him on at least 3 whaling voyages. The Journal of Annie Holmes Ricketson on the whaleship A.R. Tucker, 1871-74, from the original in the Kendall Whaling Museum, which recounted one of these voyages, was published by the Old Dartmouth Historical Society in 1858. The journal's well-rounded description of life aboard a whaler gives a fair idea of the rather strict pattern dictated by the seasonal changes in winds and currents and the migratory vagaries of sperm whales. The bark A.R. Tucker was her home for 3.5 years. The whaler went to the cruising grounds of the Indian Ocean after rounding the Cape of Good Hope. It then ventured as far as Australia and New Guinea before turning around for a return voyage along the equator and past the Seychelles and Madagascar. Mrs. Ricketson was only one of the typically purposeful women who accompanied their whaleship captain husbands for the best and the worst of what the sea might offer. The captain's wife often helped keep the bark a happy one, for she had laughter when alert to the vessel sent the hash off the table. She would happily join in gamming and saw all the sights a traveling lady should see and some she should not have. She rejoiced when the whales were caught and moaned when they escaped, and if more whales were not captured, it was not for lack of her prayers. Chapter 6, Profile of Captain John T. Gonsalves. Captain John Gonsalves, 1858-1928, was born in Brava, Cabo Verde Islands, on December 16, 1858. He spent much of his time at sea from the age of 11 as a cabin boy aboard the bark Roman, where he spent 3 years learning the basics of hunting whales. He spent a succession of years on a number of different vessels from various ports and assumed ever-increasing responsibilities, including a 4-month stint whaling with locally notable Captain Henry Mandley. His last voyage as a mate was on the schooner Rising Sun out of Provincetown, Massachusetts, after which he was master of that vessel for the next 3 years. He then served as master of 9 other vessels, including the bark Charles W. Morgan, during her 1920 voyage. His most exciting voyage was on the schooner A.M. Nicholson while on the Hatteras grounds in 1918. The vessel had a good catch of sperm oil on board, some 600 barrels worth approximately $30,000 at the time. They were approached by a German submarine that shot across my bows. After a short interchange, the German said to get aboard your vessel, get home as quick as you can, and tell the other vessel, another whaler, to go in with you, and don't let me catch you out this way again. After leaving the Nicholson, the submarine went to speak to the other whaler. Just as they were approaching, a big steamer was sighted. The Germans left the whaler to go after the steamer, which they sank. Captain Gonsalves retired from whaling about 8 years before his death, as there were no longer any whalers for him to go on. He died at the age of 70 in São Nicolau, Cabo Verde Islands, where he had gone to spend his last years. Chapter 6, Profile, Logbooks and Journals. Most logbooks contained pictorial records of all the whales encountered, using a scheme of small ink drawings of whale parts to denote details of the encounter. More artistic souls sometimes sketched whales, places they had seen, or other interesting elements within their entries. In contrast, a journal was an unofficial document that could be kept by anyone. Journals were often written similarly to logbooks, with daily entries given the same information contained in a logbook. In some cases, the only way to determine if something is a logbook or a journal is to check the name of the author against the crew list. It is a logbook if the chief mate wrote it. The museum's combined logbook collection, the largest in the world, numbers over 2,300 volumes. While the majority document Yankee whaling voyages, there are also examples from other countries. The collection covers the period from the rare 17th century vessel's log through to mid-20th century industrial whaling. Chapter 6, Profile of the Willis Family. James Monroe Willis, 1825-1909, and Elizabeth Sampson Willis, 1827-1891, spent 16 of their 45 years together as man and wife on board whaling ships. James was born in New Bedford and made his first voyage in 1839 at age 14 on the ship Selma of New Bedford. It was a 2-year whaling voyage to the South Pacific around New Zealand and Australia. His was the quintessential New Bedford whaling career as he progressed upward through the ranks over a series of voyages as greenhand, boat steerer, third mate, second mate, and master. Elizabeth was born in Lakeville, Massachusetts, and married at 19. Marrying a New Bedford whaleman in 1846 at the height of the American whaling experience was an act of great courage. She would face either perpetual loneliness at home or the uncomfortable uncertainty of life at sea. 2 months after their wedding, James left on a 3-year voyage aboard the ship Mount Vernon, where he would advance to first mate. Over the summer of 1849, James and Elizabeth agreed that she would accompany him on the voyage to the Pacific, as he had advanced to become master of the Mount Vernon. On their next voyage on the ship Rambler of New Bedford, their children Henry, 1853, Maria, 1855, and James Jr., 1856, were all born at Hilo, Hawaii. In 1871, when they set sail from New Bedford on what would be their last whaling voyage, James and Elizabeth left Henry and Maria at home with their grandparents and took son James Jr., 1856, and son Elias. On this voyage, they visited Alaska, Japan, and Melanesia, among other ports. On this trip, Jimmy turned 15, similar in age to his father when he had first set sail on a whaling voyage. Their eldest child, Henry P. Willis, eventually became a photographer in New Bedford. He recorded some of the important views of the city in its period of transition from being the world's largest whaling port to one of the nation's leading centers of cotton textile production.